it's probably not the easiest situation for a visitor to walk into a class on Revelation and kind of pick up in the middle of it. And so you may have to bear with us a little bit, maybe in some of our interpretive points that we've kind of established the way that we're looking at this book. And you'll just kind of have to jump along and go with us in that regard. And certainly we could talk more about it either during the course of the class or after the class if there's something more involved you'd like to talk about. But try to bear with us as we get into Revelation 17 this morning. In Revelation 17, we're introduced to another woman. And I say another woman because we already met one previously back in chapter 12, who we again will see in chapters 20 and 21. It may not be readily apparent that that's the same woman that we met back in chapter 12, but I certainly believe that it is the same woman later on. And when you look at this woman, there are some things about her that are noteworthy, specifically in relation to this woman in chapter 17. This first woman is revealed by one of the seven angels, specifically at her second appearance in chapter 21. She is revealed and described by one of the seven angels around the throne of God. She is dressed, she is arrayed with the sun, the moon under her feet, and a crown of stars in chapter 12. When you get to chapter 19, she is described there as dressed in fine linen, bright and pure. She gives birth to a male child who is the Christ, after which she is forced to flee into the wilderness where she is nurtured and protected by God. And we find out later in chapter 12 that she has other children as well, those who were faithful to God's commandments, those who kept the testimony of His Son. And when we get to the end of Revelation, she is identified as the beloved city, the holy city, the new Jerusalem made ready as a bride adorned for her husband. So she is identified with a city specifically. And you put all of this together, and we already talked about this when we were talking about chapter 12, but we identify this woman as the faithful people of God. And that's built out of Old Testament prophecy where the woman is regularly seen as God's people, and the Messiah comes from this woman. She's not Mary in chapter 12, but the people of God through whom the Messiah comes. But later in that same chapter, she is seen as the church who is being persecuted by the dragon. And then ultimately, she is seen as the church, the bride of Christ, perhaps depending on your interpretation of the end chapters of Revelation, the heavenly city, heaven itself. But in one form or another throughout history, this woman is the faithful people of God. Depending on your point in history would be dependent on whether it's Abraham and the faithful people of those first covenants or the Israelite people of the Mosaic covenant or the Christian people through the covenant of Christ. But she is the faithful people of God. And we'll come back to that contrast in just a second. Mark, were you going to... Oh, no, that's chapters 20 and 21. Sorry. That scripture reference at the top is Revelation 12 and Revelation 20 and 21 is what that's a reference to, not chapter 12, verses 20 and 21. Thank you. I should have made that more clear. In chapter 17, however, we are introduced to this second woman. And just like in chapter 21, the first woman is described by one of the seven angels. So also here in chapter 17, the second woman is revealed and described by one of the seven angels. In contrast, however, to the first woman who is arrayed with the sun, having the moon under her feet and a crown of stars, dressed in fine linen, bright and pure, this woman is dressed like a harlot. She is dressed like a prostitute. She is arrayed in the embellishments of earthly splendor. In contrast to the first woman who gave birth to the Christ and who had other children who are the faithful people of God who kept the commandments, this woman has children as well, but she is the mother of all of the prostitutes of the earth and the mother of all of the abominations of the earth. The first woman was identified as the beloved city, the holy city, the new Jerusalem. This woman is identified as Babylon, who holds sway over the kings of the earth, who make war against all of the saints. And so what I want you to see here at the outset before we look at more detail in this chapter is that this woman in Revelation chapter 17 is intended to stand as the absolute antithesis of the first woman. Everything that the people of God are, this woman is not. She is in every way the opposite of that first woman. She is the people who rebel against God. And in the first century context of Revelation, she is the city, the nation of Rome, and we'll talk about that more as we progress through the chapter. But really, in every point in history, just like there was always the first woman in history, whether it's Abraham and his descendants, or the nation of Israel, or the Christian people, or the people of God in heaven, there is always that first woman. Likewise, there is always the second woman as well, always those people who rebel against God. And in this context, at least, it's referring to the nation of Rome, which brings up, I think, an interesting question that you have to at least at some level wrestle with, which is exactly how many Romes are there? Because if the beast is Rome, as we talked about already, and the false prophet is the Roman system of emperor worship, and the harlot is Rome, well, just how many Romes are there? How can the harlot ride on the beast if they're both Rome? How can Rome ride on Rome? And there are different ways of approaching that. Some people look at the different figures in Revelation as different aspects of the Roman persecution. And you have the beast from the sea, which refers to the political pressure and the brute force of the Roman Empire, the persecuting pressure of the Roman Empire. And the beast from the land, or the false prophet, as that one is called later, is that false religion, that emperor worship. And the harlot here is the world of lust and all that appeals to the flesh and that kind of persecution and temptation. So that each is an aspect of Roman culture that persecuted the church and through which Satan strove to destroy Christianity. My hesitation at looking at it that way is that harlotry is consistently through the Bible seen as false religion. There is an aspect where harlotry is a literal temptation of the flesh, of course. However, when you look at the harlotress woman in the book of Proverbs, she is false religion in the book of Proverbs. When you look at God's charges against various nations, we'll consider a few later on, but you look at God's charges of harlotry against the nation of Israel and other nations, it's always false religion that's in question, not the lust of the flesh. And so there may be trying to draw too distinct a line between these different things if you look at it in that kind of categorical way. And so maybe this is just another reminder, as we've seen over and over and over in Revelation, that this is a symbolic book. It is drawing pictures for us that we are to get information from the pictures, not delineate specifically what each thing represents in all of the various details. Kind of like as we talked about several times already, that John is told to look at the lion and he looks and he sees a lamb. We're not supposed to sit there and nitpick all the details of lions and lambs and what each one represents and all of the specifics. That's not the idea of the image changing. The woman is given wings to fly into the wilderness and Satan sends a river after her to destroy her. And obviously, on one level, that's absolutely ridiculous because she has wings and a flood's not going to kill her if she has wings. She could fly over it. Well, again, that's not the point to nitpick all of those kinds of details. Maybe the same thing is true here, that Rome can, in one sense, ride on the back of Rome without it being any kind of conflict if we understand that this is a symbolic picture that we're to get information from, not to nitpick at all of those details. Any questions from this kind of introductory information before we get into chapter 17 itself? Or comments or anything else. All right, well, moving on into the chapter then, we'll begin with verses 1 through 6. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality, and with the wine of whose sexual immorality the dwellers on earth have become drunk." And he carried me away in the spirit to a wilderness, And I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and it had 7 heads and 10 horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of sexual immorality. And on her head was written a name of mystery, Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes and of earth's abominations. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And we will stop there. One thing that is noteworthy at the outset that is helpful as we look at this is to pick up some of the Old Testament background of this kind of language. There are 4 cities specifically in the Old Testament that are identified with harlotry in prophecy. And each of them was known for different kinds of wickedness. They were all false religions. They were all pagan in one way or the other. But each of them kind of had a slightly different aspect as far as their false religion and their wickedness in other ways. Nineveh is referred to as a harlot in Nahum chapter 3. And Nineveh was a nation that wasn't just full of wickedness and false idolatry. Nineveh was a ruthless and evil and just violent people. Tyre is referred to as a harlot in Isaiah chapter 23. And Tyre was known for its commerce and its seafaring nature and its trading around the world. Babylon is referred to as a harlot in Isaiah 47. And if there's one of these passages that probably stands as the backdrop for this image, it would be that one, since this is the nation, since this harlot is referred to as Babylon here in this chapter. But Babylon was not just a false religious, but it was a mistress of wealth and pleasure and all of those kinds of things. And then finally, Jerusalem itself is referred to as a harlot in Isaiah chapter 1. And really in a variety of places, the people of God are said to play the harlot with these nations as well. And Jerusalem is really the great religious harlot. Whereas all of these other nations, all of these other cities, of course, there was religious harlotry, to use the symbol, going on in those other nations as well, because they were pagan people, they were idolatrous people. Jerusalem is the one that was really the great religious harlot, because they should have known better. They should have been following God, and they instead turned to follow idols instead of that. And maybe what we're seeing in this harlot of Revelation 17 is not just the backdrop of Isaiah 47, where it's talking about the harlotry of Babylon, but in the nation of Rome, really a synthesis of all of the harlotry that had gone on before it. We saw that same picture as the beast came up from the sea, and the beast looked like all of the beasts of Daniel chapter 7, kind of meshed into one super beast. I don't know if that's the right thing to call it or not. But it was not just one wicked beast coming up from the sea, but it was the embodiment of all of the cities and all of the wickedness and all of the beasts that came before and fought against God's people. Maybe the same thing is true here, where Rome is not just following the path of the harlotry of Babylon, but is following the path of the harlotry of all of these people who have come before it. And it is kind of the embodiment of all of that. And you certainly could see that as Rome being a brute force and ruthless kind of people. And it's a city of commerce, it's a city of wealth and pleasure, but also it is this great religious harlot, because the emperors were demanding worship of themselves. It wasn't just the Roman pantheon of gods that they made people worship. It was the emperors themselves that they forced worship to. And there are the kings of the earth here in chapter 17 as well, who come and drink of the sexual immorality. They've become drunk of this. They've committed adultery with this harlot as well, which is to say that all of the nations that are participating in relations with the city of Rome of one kind or another, that they've allied themselves, they've allowed themselves to become prosperous at the hand of Rome. Well, how do they do that? How do they successfully go about interacting in commerce with Rome, except they don't offend the Roman emperor? well, how do they not offend the Roman emperor? Well, they do what the Roman emperor says, and they bow down and they worship the emperor as well. So these kings are swept away in this sexual immorality as well.
What all of that says can be found. What we are. Morality that God holds the nations to, both in commerce and in their dealings with one another. One of the woes in Habakkuk is that you make the other nations to be like you, the prostitute them.
Yeah.
And that's a picture of this part of it also.
Very good. Anything else? Okay, well, the angel takes John to the wilderness to show him this picture, and that may just be an appropriate setting for a vision of judgment, and this is a vision of judgment. One of the other things that's common about all of these passages of harlotry in the prophets is they're not just saying these people are harlots and that's a bad thing. These are all passages of judgment where God is coming in judgment against these nations because of this. So when John starts saying there is this harlot that is Babylon, which ultimately is the Roman people, there is implicitly in that an indication that this is going to be a judgment against these people. And that becomes less implicit and more explicit as this chapter goes on. But know that that's what's going on. And maybe taking him into the wilderness is just a kind of an appropriate setting for a vision. But on the other hand, throughout the book of Revelation, the wilderness is seen as something in opposition to the great city of Rome. It's a place of safety. It's a place of refuge for God's people. And maybe what's going on here is that this is the place where this great city that looks so nice to all the world, you take it out and you compare it with God's safety and God's provision, and suddenly you can see it for what it is. It's not a beautiful woman anymore. It's obviously a prostitute that is in question. And maybe that's the contrast that is intended to be set up by being taken to the wilderness. Regardless, she is identified specifically as Babylon, and there is that initially in the symbolism of, where'd it go? It being a city on many waters, a harlot on many waters, which I can't find. There it is, verse 1. You'd think I would look there first. A prostitute who is seated on many waters. In Babylon itself, that's kind of a backdrop to Babylon. It was built on the Euphrates River and its tributaries and its aqueducts and all of those things. And so it's a reference to that, but also it's a good picture of the city of Rome because Rome was a port city, a harbor city, and it was built on waters itself. But that's not really the main reason that we should equate Babylon with Rome. Babylon is often equated with Rome in the first century, especially among Christian literature. They're kind of seen as one and the same. Babylon was a type of Rome. You could talk about Rome by talking about Babylon. But beyond that, this harlot is seen as taking the blood of Christian martyrs, which obviously is not literal Babylon. That was not going on in the city of Babylon at this time. It was going on in the city of Rome. There were the names of blasphemy written on the harlot. And again, this goes back to the emperor worship and the emperors demanding that they be treated as gods. They took blasphemous titles for themselves. They demanded that they be called divine. They demanded that they be called Savior, and they demanded that they be called Lord and things like that. So the blasphemous names are written on the harlot. And then specifically in verse 18, she is identified as the great city. And there is no possible way that John could have written a letter in the first century to a bunch of cities in Asia Minor and mentioned the great city, and they would have thought of anything other than the city of Rome. That's obviously what is referred to there. Also, her name is a mystery, which indicates that it's not talking about Babylon literally, so it's talking about something else. If you're reading from a King James Version, they interpret this as mystery being part of the name. I would think that that's not the better way to take it, and most translations reflect that, that it's saying that the name is a mystery, not the name is mystery. But it's something that's not open, not obvious to all. It's something that has to be revealed. And then finally, that this is this harlot is the mother of all of Earth's abominations, which was a very fitting way to describe the city of Rome. And you might think that's kind of a mean thing to say about a city. Well, God's never held back in terms of saying mean things about cities if they're wicked people. But what is more significant is if you go back and look at first century Roman writing, you find this very same sort of thing said about the city of Rome. Juvenal was a Roman author who described a Roman empress who would go and incognito disguise herself and serve in one of the common brothels in the city. The empress would go and be a prostitute to the common folks, just because that's the sort of city that it was. Tacitus described the city of Rome as a place, quote, where all the horrible and shameful things in the world congregate to find a home. That's how they saw their own city. Seneca called Rome a filthy sewer. You put it all together, and there's nothing new that John is saying here. One commentator said that John's picture of Rome is not in the least exaggerated. It's actually restrained in comparison with some of the pictures which the Romans themselves drew of their own civilization. The Roman people knew how wicked and terrible this city was. So John's not saying anything new when he says this city is the mother of all prostitutes and all of the earth's abominations. The Roman people would have probably given that one a hearty amen because they were saying the same kind of thing about it as well. Jay?
Kind of the same thing in Las Vegas. They consider it Sin City.
Yeah, Sin City. That's a good analogy. And really, there's a whole lot of those. I mean, to take a track aside for a second, cities are constantly identified with wickedness. It wasn't God who built a city. God planted a garden. Man started building cities, and they started lauding themselves and their great achievements of these great cities. And throughout history, cities have been identified with wickedness. And I mean, it's that way today, too. What do you think of when you think of Las Vegas or Amsterdam or Rio or New Orleans or San Francisco? I mean, you could go down the line, and those are just the really obvious ones. But really, cities tend to be places of wickedness. However, what's very remarkable about that, to take our sidetrack a step further away from the book of Revelation, is that in the greatest of these cities, the builders have always planted gardens. You think about New York Central Park, and that is just an absolutely amazing park in the middle of a city, an undisturbed refuge of a garden. You think of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, one of the seven wonders of the world, and on down the lines. These people planted gardens in their cities because they knew there was something missing from that city. Somewhere deep down, they realized something is missing and something is not right here. They just didn't know the way back to God. And ultimately, at the end, what we'll see in Revelation to bring us back to our own context is that God will again plant a garden. It will be a new city. It will be the heavenly Jerusalem, but that will not find its fulfillment in skyscrapers and neon lights, but in a new garden that God has planted where we will be with Him again. Now, back to what we're talking about. Does anyone have any other, I guess, questions or comments through the first six verses? We'll need to carry on. All right, well, continuing on then in verse 7, actually the end of verse 6, "When I saw her, I marveled greatly. But the angel said to me, 'Why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and the beast with the seven heads and 10 horns that carries her. The beast that you saw was and is not, and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. And the dwellers on earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world will marvel to see the beast because it was and is not and is to come. This calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. They are also seven kings, five of whom have fallen. One is, the other has not yet come. And when he does come, he must remain only a little while. As for the beast that was and is not, it is an eighth, but it belongs to the seven, and it goes to destruction. And the 10 horns that you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received royal power, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour together with the beast. They are of one mind and hand over their power and authority to the beast. They will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them, for He is Lord of lords and King of kings. And those with Him are called chosen and faithful." Well, John marvels at the harlot, And the angel says, I will tell you about this harlot, and proceeds to tell him about the beast. Instead of the harlot, which again shows that they are interconnected, you can't separate one from the other. It's the same picture. Maybe we're trying to draw too fine of a line if we're distinguishing Rome from Rome in one context or another, and what's going on. But this beast is said that it was, but it is not, but it shall come. This is almost certainly an intentional contrast of chapter 1 and verse 4, where it is speaking there about God and Christ by extension, who is and who was and who is to come. And that's language we've seen in a few places as well. So that just as the harlot is seen as a contrast of the woman, so now the beast is seen as a contrast of Christ. It's also the same idea probably of chapter 13 and verse 3, where we saw this beast previously that seemed to suffer a mortal wound but recovered. It looked like a mortal wound, but it wasn't. And again, that's probably a parody of the lamb that was standing as though slain. It looked like it had been slain, but it had not. Now the beast has that same kind of thing about it as well. And you see that same picture here that it was, but it's not now, but it will come. And in the context of Rome, that probably refers to Nero being or dying in the nation, seeming to be in uproar and about to fall apart, to be in this kind of turmoil, but then regaining its strength along the way. Seen in a bigger picture than that, with the beast being symbolic for every rebellion against God's people, every nation that rises up against God's people, it's just a reminder, perhaps, that evil and world kingdoms may seem to disappear from time to time, but understand that it only seems to disappear. It's always there, and it will always return again. But also, that it will rise up, and that it will go to destruction. This is the main contrast between Christ, who was and is to come, and shall be forevermore, and this beast that was but is not, but will come, but ultimately will go to destruction. There is not an eternality to this beast, that it will not be forevermore, except that it will be punished forevermore for rebelling against God. And one of the things that John never loses sight of is the certainty of the overthrow of evil, that God ultimately is in control. You want to boil down the entire book of Revelation into two words that show up over and over and over again. Well, actually, they don't show up, but the theme shows up over and over and over again in the book of Revelation. What Revelation can be boiled down to is Jesus wins. That's it. That's the bottom line in all of these visions and all of these symbols and all of these pictures, is that Jesus wins in the final analysis. And that's what we see here again. This beast, it seems so terrible, it seems so powerful, yet it will not be. It will come again, but when it comes again, its coming is ultimately going to be to destruction. The seven mountains that are referred to, there is a sense in which this also points to the city of Rome as an interpretation of this, because Rome was known as the city that was built on seven hills. That's all over ancient literature outside the Bible, so that would obviously be an indication to these people that is being talked, the Revelation, or the... I'm sorry, that Rome is under discussion here in reference to the city, the seven mountains. I'm going to get my words straight in a second. But also it has a symbolic meaning. It's the seven kings, five of whom have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. Well, what on earth does this mean? What is it talking about? And there's been a variety of interpretations suggested, and I'll run through them briefly so you can at least know what people have suggested that this might mean. Some have suggested that this is referring to pagan kingdoms in general, beginning back with Babylonia and working its way through Rome. And when I say Babylonia, I don't mean Babylon of Daniel's day. I mean Babylonia of ancient Babylonia. Think Genesis 10 and Nimrod, who built the city of Babylon and the Tower of Babel. That Babylonia is where this view begins and progresses all the way through until you get to the sixth, the one that is the city of Rome. And then the seventh is kind of a collective for every anti-Christian judgment, a government that comes after that. And that's where this approach kind of loses me, that if you're going to be very specific about everything and who it refers to all the way through Rome, then to turn number 7 into a catch-all for everything else after Rome seems to be maybe not the best way to approach this text. Others have seen it as specific Roman emperors. And depending on what view you take of Revelation, you're going to start your counting in different places. People who take an earlier date and believe that the harlot is Jerusalem instead of Rome, they begin counting with Julius Caesar and work their way up to Nero being the one that is now. Those who don't take Jerusalem, those who believe this is talking about Rome, will start counting with Augustus because he was the first real emperor of Rome. And you'll probably skip the few that came after Nero that were never really emperors embraced by the people to get to Domitian being the one. But the bottom line with this is that you read 5 commentators that take this view and you're going to have 5 different lists of emperors. People just simply can't come to a consensus as to who these emperors are if that's what this interpretation is, which doesn't mean that it's wrong. One of them might be right, but I think it does make it a little more suspect as to who it is, or to this view in general. What might be a better approach is to remember that the book of Revelation is a symbolic book, and to remember that the number 7 specifically in the book of Revelation is used symbolically over and over and over. So when we get here to 7 kings, maybe we're not supposed to go through history and start counting kings so much as to see this as the Roman Empire as a historic whole. That this is referring to the Roman Empire in its entirety. The 7 kings represent that entire period of Roman domination, regardless of the exact number of emperors who sat on the throne in Rome. That doesn't matter so much when you're dealing in symbolism. The important point here is that the end is drawing near. And if you look beyond the immediate context of the Roman Empire and you see this beast and the symbolism as people who oppose God regardless of the time period, you're looking for an application to us today or an application to somebody before the time of John, perhaps, it would stand then for every kingdom that would oppose God, regardless of whether they were past, present, or future. That's kind of way I'm leaning right now as to interpreting the 7 kings, but you ask me next week and I might change my mind by then. So, the 8th is the beast, and it's a little bit harder to be sure as to what exactly that's referring to, because the beast is Rome still. And we're not given a lot of detail beyond that it's of the same sort as the 7. The significance there isn't, again, to figure out exactly who it refers to and what is specific about that and all of those things. The significant point that John makes about the 8th is that it is coming to destruction as well. It's almost an afterthought. I got to talk about this 8th as well, but what's important is that it will go to destruction as well, that God is still in control. Well, we're quickly running out of time. The 10 kings are, the 10 horns are 10 kings. These are people who are future world leaders, people who weren't in authority yet. It says they will be given an authority. They would ally themselves with the beast, with Rome, against God's kingdom for a while. Rome will give them some kind of authority and they will fight against the Lamb. But these people are willing collaborators, not people who are forced into some kind of unwelcome association. They're not strong-armed into fighting against the Lamb. They're more than happy to receive their authority from Rome, to worship the beast, to worship the emperor, to have that power, and to fight against God's people. However, they also have a very important part in the punishment of the harlot, which is the last few verses of chapter 17. The angel said to me, "The waters that you saw where the prostitute is seated are peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. And the 10 horns that you saw, they and the beast will hate the prostitute. They will make her desolate, naked, and devour her flesh and burn her up with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose by being of one mind and handing over their royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman that you saw is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth." Well, the waters that we see that the harlot was sitting on are the various peoples of the empire, which again points to historic Rome. One of their great weaknesses as an empire was their inability to bring all the nations that they've conquered all of these diverse peoples into one. They could conquer, they could control by force. They were very strong people that could impose their will, but it had no cohesive power to submit those conquered peoples into a homogeneous kingdom. And so they were always having to fight against uprisings of one kind or another. And that's what would happen with these ten horns. They would turn against the harlot. And this is another picture that is rooted in Old Testament imagery. If you go back to Ezekiel 23, and I was hoping we'd have time to read a few of these verses, but you'll have to check this out on your own. Ezekiel's allegory of Oholibah, which is a picture of the city of Jerusalem that doted on the Assyrians and was defiled by the Babylonians and played the harlot in the land of Egypt. The judgment that comes in Ezekiel 23, that language is almost identical to the language here in Revelation 17, that God will judge one harlot the same way that He judged the other, that the beast and the ten kings would turn in hatred, and you see that same kind of language in Ezekiel 23, that they would make her desolate and naked, and again you see that same kind of language, that they would eat her flesh here in Revelation 17, that they would burn her utterly with fire. Again, it's the same language that is used there, so this is drawing out of that same kind of Old Testament language. The main point of significance that I'll end with today in these last few verses about this judgment is that these people aren't turning against God, against Rome because they decided that they were going to turn against Rome. They're not turning against Rome because they got fed up with Roman power and so they decided they're going to rebel. They're turning against Rome because God drove them to turn against Rome. God is the driving force behind this judgment. They're led by God to do that. And that certainly would be a welcome reminder to these people that God is forever sovereign and that He continues to occupy the throne of the universe. Regardless of what it seems like with these beasts and this harlot and all of this power that Roman people has and all of these Christians dying these terrible deaths, nothing has changed since Revelation 4 and 5. God is still on the throne of eternity. God is still in control, and He is still ruling, and He will judge, and this nation will fall in the face of God. And one of the great points behind this is to see just how sovereign God is. There is no dualism in the Bible. There is no eternal struggle between good and evil where these forces have been fighting against each other forever and you don't really know who's going to win at the end of the day. God is sovereign. God will win. Evil is not eternal. Evil will be put to death again. And God will rule. And you see that because even evil in the final analysis serves the purposes of God. And how powerful is God then that He can take these wicked people who are doing these wicked things, who are striving against Him and fighting against His Son and His purposes, and use those very things that are in opposition to Him to serve His purpose of destroying the nation of Rome. And that has always been the case of history. No matter how wicked someone is, no matter how much they are rebelling against God, God can still use that to serve His purposes. And that's what we see here at the end of chapter 17, the sovereignty of God in judgment. Thank you for your kind attention this morning.